Hello, Christopher, can you hear me?
Hello.
Hello, how are you today?
Pretty good, how are you? You wake up with a case of the bad accent?
Oh, I can't believe. Happened many times.
I guess so. What'd you have for breakfast?
I went to McDonald's.
Oh.
Oh, I had a sausage biscuit and a hash brown and a coffee.
I see. So you went the healthy route this morning?
Correct.
Do the kids like McDonald's?
They like chicken nuggets.
For breakfast?
Oh, that's the only thing that they like from McDonald's, though.
Oh.
So that was it.
Did they get breakfast from McDonald's too, or just you?
I was going to get something for Stacy. She likes their bagel sandwiches there.
Mm-hmm.
They still don't have any bagels. They stopped doing those, I guess, in March with the pandemic.
Oh, interesting.
I don't know that in particular, but
yeah.
So how are you doing?
Pretty good.
How's Kara?
Pretty good. You know, I feel like this year it's like you have to put an asterisk next mm-hmm. year response to that question.
Pretty good, all things considered.
All things considered, yeah, that's what the asterisk means, I guess.
Yeah,
I think, generally speaking, my mood has been pretty decent for everything that's going on, but I have to admit and be honest that I'm definitely not as impacted as a lot of people are by everything that's going on as either, though, you know?
Right.
So I've been pretty lucky in that respect, so.
Oh, for sure.
But,
same here. I assume you're working from home still, or no?
Yeah, but I already did, so.
Oh, you were doing it all the time even before?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah, so that's part of what I mean, even on a just day-to-day routine kind of level, I haven't been that impacted.
Yeah, makes sense. We were told a couple weeks, there had been rumors going for a while, but we were told a week or so ago that we're going to continue to work from home through the end of September.
Mm-hmm.
All of the higher ups come right out and say they cannot, because, like, you know, I work for a call center,
mm-hmm.
Like schedules and stuff prepared. So I don't specifically, you know, I'm not in the calls. Well, I mean, I could work on this. I've been working on the same floor as the call center, but there's other floors. But regardless, everything, like, all the higher ups are just, I mean, there's no way that they can imagine that on October 1st, people are just going to be coming back to work.
Yeah.
To the offices. They did make an announcement that some departments, not ours at this point, but some they're just transitioning permanently to work from home,
mm-hmm.
which is like, it's just crazy, to be honest with you, in terms of, if you would have told me a year ago that this is what would happen and the company would be the one initiating it, I'd be like, there's absolutely no way. But yeah, here we are. You know, it's obviously a very different world. So I'm thinking that it may actually end up coming to, at least for my type of work, that I might be a permanent work from home person as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess we'll see. It's definitely you know, it's definitely a crazy situation.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard that sounds similar to what's going on at other companies as well.
Yeah.
There's a sort of reevaluation of, I mean, it's unfortunate the circumstances that are causing it, but I think there were a lot of cases where companies were holding on to the office as a workplace for just old-fashioned reasons.
Yes, and that's exactly where my mindset kind of goes, because they've always been very kind of stuck in their ways.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any way that anything like this would have ever happened if it hadn't been for, you know, the virus. And it's exactly like you said, it's like terrible circumstances that initiate these type of changes, but they're probably in 2020, it's probably long overdue that, you know, some of this flexibility and some of these changes were probably needed. It's like you said, it's just a shame that it's something like this that causes it to have to happen.
Yeah. Seems like most of the time that's where change comes from, though, is when it's forced, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, and it's not like some of the concerns that people have about productivity and stuff. It's, as someone who used to work in an office, there are definitely plenty of ways to waste your time and not do work in the office. Like, being in the office is not really, you know, people, for every distraction you might have at home, you know, there's plenty of people that waste tons of time just chit-chatting or,
oh, you know, 100%.
Hanging out in the kitchen or whatever, so.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that that's what they're learning, is that, you know, everything that I've heard is that the numbers, if anything, are actually better than they were when everyone was in the office.
Yeah.
So, it's a lot to do with what you say. Yes, of course there's going to be some, especially in this circumstance, where those that have kids and stuff like that, the kids are literally right there.
Yeah.
So yes, there's going to be some distractions, but they pale in comparison to have to be out on a floor with maybe 100 other people and just constantly having interruptions.
Right.
Stacy says the same thing with her stuff. She's able to get so much more work done because she's not constantly getting the pop-ins for people walking by and deciding they need to talk to her or ask her questions about stuff, or whether it's work-related or not. She's not getting these interruptions anymore. So yeah, I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
So I guess, well, you know, I mean, we'll see what happens in the future, but I'm glad that, you know, that you're staying healthy and Kara, and it's just, as scary as things were, I'm very grateful that we live in New York, where there was a very specific, whether you agreed with it or not, there's a very specific message that was told in terms of what you need to do.
Yeah.
There wasn't a lot of confusion.
Mm-hmm.
And now, of course, you know, as we get to the point where everyone, all these other states are spiking, it's, you know, you got to worry about it coming back here. But I don't know. I try not to think about it too much.
Yeah, there's only so much that you can control yourself.
Well, that's it, yeah.
And, yeah. But, well, obviously Mike is not with us today. He's attending a COVID party.
In New Mexico, of all places.
Yeah.
Oh.
I guess it could be worse. No, obviously, of course he's not, but he is in New Mexico. But
visiting the folks, I assume, huh?
I assume, yeah. Some kind of, well, that's good. They were able to must have been able to figure something out to be able to do that.
Yeah, that's nice. We haven't done much of anything. We've ordered food out, and we did go to this animal place, Hidden Valley Animal Adventure thing. It's not too far from here. And but you know, it's one of those things where you just drive through it to see the animals.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's really no contact with people. But it was, other than that, we've been pretty much sticking close to home.
Yeah, same here. I mean, even as someone that's a homebody, I have been experiencing a little bit of wanderlust.
You have, yeah.
Yeah, just a little restlessness. I gotta think about ways to just maybe go to the park or something like that, just to get out of the house somehow, in a safe way. You know, well, there's been some years where we've done a couple trips, but usually we'll do our main vacation in the fall. And but by this point of the year, we've usually taken a few weekend trips. So I'm noticing a little bit of the lack of that, and that's not a complaint. You know, that's, oh, I couldn't go on my little vacations, but yeah, I'm noticing a little bit. Noticing a little bit of restlessness, where I don't usually experience that too much, and don't need to get out that much to feel content. But
yeah, I think it's pretty normal now, and like, even lately I've been feeling pretty okay. But there's certainly been times in the past where you know, past couple months, that it's like, after work, we'll like go for a walk, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all well and good, but it's like, we're just taking a walk around the neighborhood or to Ellicott Creek Park, which is within walking distance. And after a while, it's like, I'm sick of even just going to doing that same walk over and over again. And, again, it's like these are small little luxury complaints, but yeah, I mean, they can still affect your emotional state. So in that aspect, it's, you know, that is important, because you got to make sure that in terms of emotionally, psychologically, that you're, you know, taking care of yourself.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah. How have your kids been in terms of staying occupied and stuff? I know some parents are kind of struggling to keep their kids occupied, and
yeah, we've been extremely fortunate. I think for two things. One, their age that they enjoy being, you know, having mom and dad around.
Mm-hmm.
Not old, you know, older that, you know, we're the last people they want to see 24 hours a day. Right. They still love that all the time, mm-hmm. and the fact that they have each other. They have playmate, you know, all the time, where I've heard a lot of our friends that have just one child, it's tough, because it's either they have to constantly they always have to be the playmate for the child, and of course that's not possible, and so they're constantly trying to keep them occupied, and it becomes very hard. These two have been absolutely incredible. If I had to ask, like, who's holding up the best out of the four of us, it's those two. They're just totally fine with hanging out, playing with each other. And don't get me wrong, especially like the last couple of weeks, they'll get on each other's nerves.
Yeah.
And just hear like one or the other just going through a whole list of complaints about the other.
Mm-hmm.
But,
all kids are going to have their moments, but
right. But you know, overall, I mean, they are just—they've been excellent. And you know, me and Stacy work from home, so 5 days a week, we're need to be at our desks working. Apart mm-hmm. from, of course, like, you know, we'll make them lunch and stuff like that. And you know, if something comes up, they need us. You know, we'll we'll excuse ourselves and run over there, but it's very, very rare that like there's an issue that we need to go and handle. They're just keeping themselves occupied, and we don't allow them to spend a lot of time in front of a screen. Mm-hmm. We'll let them do like an hour in the morning and then an hour in the afternoon. And other than that, you know, we're like, you've got to play, you've got to be active. And this past week has been kind of tough because it was so incredibly hot, we weren't going to send them outside.
Yeah.
So they managed to find things to entertain themselves inside the house. I'm really impressed because I don't think that I would have been handling it as well as they are. Mm-hmm. At their age, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I feel very fortunate.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like pretty not having to deal with what some people are having to deal with.
Yeah, pretty lucky. We do allow them on occasion, apart from their screen time, to FaceTime their friends.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it is, you know, they are looking at the screen, but they're interacting with friends or
yeah,
you know, sometimes relatives, like parents or whatever. Yeah. Yeah. So we'll let them do that, and I think that that's I think that that helps too, and especially I know we've talked to the other parents, and they definitely appreciate that too, because it kind of occupies their single child for a while too. So it's a win-win. But yeah, it's been okay, I have to say.
Yeah, I know my nephew has been doing some of that, like conference calls, not the right word, but
yeah.
But yeah, doing some of the like the video chat with his friends and stuff. Which, I mean, he's all about that because he's super into technology and stuff, even though he's like, I think he's 7 maybe, or going to be 7 or something like that, but he's like real into iPhones and and like any of that kind of stuff, like iPhones and like iPad, Apple stuff, and like, you know, Alexa, Amazon Echo and those kind of things he finds really interesting.
Yeah.
He seems to have like a tech mechanically inclined mind.
Yeah.
That was kind of the funny thing about him when, like, I don't know, he was like 4 or something like that. He was obsessed with toilets for a while. And he was watching YouTube videos about toilets, and like, he had just like really interested in how toilets worked and stuff. Like, we have it was here when Care About the House, we have just like a random toilet in the basement.
Huh?
It's not like a finished off bathroom down there or anything like that. Like, I mean, I guess technically we could build something around it, but it's just connected into one of the pipes down there, and next, like, you know, there's like the slop sink for the washer and dryer and stuff like that, but it's just a random toilet out in the open.
That's awesome. Hey, you know what? If there was an absolute emergency, it's there.
Oh yeah, I mean, we only have one bathroom, so like if Kara's in the shower or something and I really gotta go, I just go down there and use it, because I mean, it's just the two of us, no one else is
gonna. Sure. Yeah.
I just, you know, it's just like one huge bathroom down there, I guess.
Right.
But like, but yeah, so the fact that we had a toilet in the basement just fascinated him, and we would have to like take turns going down there with him, so that he could just, and he could just check out the toilet in the basement, and it would be, we would have to basically limit the amount of time, because he would just hang out down there and look at this toilet in the basement, and just, I don't know what was so interesting about it, but he found it really fascinating. Yeah,
it's so funny that you never know what's going to hit a kid, you know what I mean, in a certain way, and for him it was toilets.
Yeah, he's kind of moved on from those, but I see a link kind of like, you know, he was actually interested in how the toilet worked, like,
Right.
And he would try to reiterate things that he would learn from his YouTube plumbing videos. And he didn't have the command over language to make it intelligible to someone else. But he was obviously learning stuff about, you know, the plumbing and stuff, and I see kind of a connection there with his interest in, like, the mechanical aspect of how a toilet worked, too, where he's getting into more, like complicated electronic technology now. But yeah, it's kind of interesting to see what they latch on to and what they find interesting at that age.
Yeah, it's amazing. That's kind of cool. You just don't know. You just don't know what's gonna grab their attention for a while or whatever, and it's kind of neat to see.
Yeah. I don't know if you and Mike talked about the last couple times, but there was a few comic creators that we lost in recent months.
I don't think we talked about them at all. No. I know about Denny O'Neill.
Yeah, I know if Mike was on today, I bet he would be talking about The Question, because he's been raving about that on Twitter.
Yeah, I do want to read that at some point.
Oh, you haven't read it at all?
I have owned the first couple issues, maybe, and that's all that I've read.
Yeah, I've been reading it as a part of my 80s DC reading project. I think I just read issue 11, I think, is how far I'm at. But yeah, it's really, really good.
Yeah, I just looked up. I only own issue 1 and 2, so that's all that I would have read. But I mean, now I look at it and I'm like, oh, that looks really, really interesting. So at some point, I'll get around to it on the DC Universe app.
Yeah. The other one I was thinking of was Joe Sinnott.
That's right, yes.
Which I think he was at a pretty advanced age, I would imagine.
Yeah, I want to say he was in maybe 94, right around there.
Yeah. Let's look. 93, yeah.
93, okay. Yeah. He was so instrumental back in the 60s with the start of everything, and he was a huge person in the business, that's for sure.
Yeah, obviously primarily known as an inker.
Yep.
Worked with Dave Jack Kirby a lot,
and his brother Dave.
Yeah, the lesser known Dave Kirby.
Yep.
So yeah, 93. That's. I'd be happy with that.
Oh yeah.
I also want to mention Tomorrow's Publishing. Since a lot of their publications are retro-related, a lot of the stuff that they publish, the books and the magazines that they publish, I mean, maybe all of it is, or close to all of it is retro-related. I know that I got an email from them, it's been several weeks now, but they're definitely being hit by the COVID effect on the economy. So that's just something to be aware of if you're not already. They, I know, are doing some discounts and deals and stuff like that just to pull some business in, because I think it sounded from their email that it's bad enough that they're struggling to stay afloat. So, you know, I just thought that listeners of this probably have purchased stuff from them in the past, or at least are aware of them, and might be, you know, something to take a look and browse. If there's anything of interest that you want to pick up from them to support them, but yeah, cool.
Yeah, for sure. I'd like to take a look. Yeah, I'll get what's back. It's called Back Issue, right?
Yeah, Back Issue. That's the one that's like Bronze Age related stuff.
Yeah, I'll get that every once in a while and stuff. I'll have to take a look at the website and see what they're offering for a subscription or something like that.
Yeah, they have the Back Issue. They have Alter Ego, which has its roots in a Roy Thomas fanzine, I believe, originally, but that tends to cover more of like a Silver Age topics. And then, you know, they have some other magazines and books and stuff like that also. But I used to, I have a habit now of sort of forgetting about them, because when I used to do DCBS orders, I would usually put one or both of those on my order. So I would get them pretty consistently for a while there, but I kind of tend to forget. But cool publisher of comics related materials. So
yeah, good call out.
Yeah, but it's been that's definitely been a tough time for the comic industry for sure, all around.
For sure. Oh, speaking of comic shops, I don't know if you follow the news at all, or I know you're not on Facebook, right?
Yeah, I think, I don't know how long it's been since I canceled my account, but
came off for a while. Yeah. So I don't know if you caught it, but are you familiar with or at least heard of the store Pulp 716?
Yes.
Yeah, so they've got two locations in the North Towns, one in Lockport, the other one, I want to say, North Tonawanda. And they have been nominated for an Eisner Award.
Oh,
for
nice.
Yeah.
That's so, the one that has, bubble tea and stuff, too,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yes. And I have to say, if it wasn't for the fact that I've been going to Queen City forever, that would be the store. Like if AMO Queen City just said, you know what, I'm shutting down, whatever, that would be the LCS that I went to, is Pulp 716. They're not an old fashioned type comic store. They don't have a back-ish collection to speak of, yeah. But the way that they present themselves, and social media and stuff is just so impressive. Mm-hmm. And they're just constantly something that they really like, they just publicize over and over again, to the point where I think I mentioned a while back when he came, but you know, James Tynan is writing that Something Is Killing the Children, and they just kept talking about it, the Pulp 716, like nonstop, that he reached out to them and said, I want to come there and do like a signing. So he was there for a day. He drove up here and he did a signing, and of course he was just about to take over Batman at that time. So you know, I mean, that's he's a big writer, you know. And the other thing that I find very, very unique is when they have incentive covers, when the store gets incentive covers, they just randomly put them in subscribers' pull bags. And if they have extra, if they have, you know, if it's one that's a thing where they have enough, or they just don't have a lot of subscribers, they just stick them right in the pile. So they did a Negan Lives one shot. Kirkman and Adler did for I don't know if you've heard about this at all, but it was for they produced it for free and they had Diamond send it to comic shops for free, so all the money that the comic shops get, they just now can keep for that. That was their way. Well, anyhow, they had two variant covers, one with like a gold logo and one with a silver one. Apparently they're going for upwards of $200 on eBay. Pulp 716 just put them in subscribers' bag. They got one of each. They just stuck them in two subscribers' bags.
Wow.
Regular price. I'm like, that's insane. But anyhow, I know that that's not a retro thing, but I did want to mention that they're, just because they're local, that they've got, that they're nominated for an Eisner, because I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's cool. I sort of forgot about them. At least I haven't thought about them recently, but I do remember either when it was on and I was on Facebook or whatever, but I do remember looking at pictures of their shops and meaning to go visit one just to check it out in person, because they definitely, like you said, seem to be doing a really good job of taking that like more modern approach to a comic shop, with not just the fact that they offer beverages and stuff like that and like make their stores a welcoming place to hang out, but looking at the pictures, it seemed like they were successful in creating a different kind of vibe and also being a lot more inclusive.
Yes, they're owned and operated almost exclusively by women.
Mm-hmm.
They may have some male employees, but almost always you'll see women and employees in the shop.
Yeah.
But yes, very, very inclusive. You said it. I mean, that's the inclusive, welcoming. They have because they sell those bubble teas and pastries and stuff, like they have tables, you know, where you can sit down. They have an arrangement of games that, you know, you could just sit and hang out and play and drink bubble tea or whatever you want to do, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And then they have the whole comic side too. And so honestly, in, you know, Western New York, they were the one comic shop that wasn't closed at all because they sold food and beverages.
Oh.
So yeah, they were open
really
during the pandemic.
That. Yeah.
Yeah. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
I wonder if that will
sound like they
influence other. I was gonna say, obviously, like they've been around a while. It wasn't like that was part of their business plan. Like, if there's a global pandemic, we'll be able to stay open if we serve food. But
right.
I wonder if some shops will, in hindsight, think about maybe we should start doing that if we do have to be closed again.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
They obviously won't get as many brownie points for that.
Cause, no,
because they didn't think of it ahead of, or they didn't do it before there was threat of
exactly
the end of the world.
Yep. But yeah. So, you want to start covering some stuff?
Yeah. Sure.
All right. If you want, I can go.
Okay.
The first one I'm going to cover, and it's because it just recently came out as a facsimile edition, but it's Detective Comics number 475. This is a fairly famous one. This is probably why they made a facsimile for it. But I think, I don't know if I've ever read this one before. Maybe in a collection years ago. I don't remember, but. This is the one that have the laughing fish, the Joker fish. But it didn't seem familiar what exactly, what he was doing with them, to be honest. So if I did read it, it was a long time ago. But this, story, starts out with Batman, coming in, to Silver St. Cloud's, apartment through the window, and they have a quick conversation because Bruce has the impression that she knows that Bruce Wayne is Batman, and so he kind of wants to kind of clear the air with her and I guess, you know, kind of figure out, okay, is this true, and not to lie to her, but to come right out and be truthful. And, because he actually is in love with her. When they start talking and he kind of like says, oh, it seemed like there was something that you wanted to tell me before. And we got, sidetracked, and she's like, oh, no, there was nothing that I needed to tell you. You know, you must have made a mistake, and he notices that she's shaking, but you know, finally she says, you know, is there something else you need? Because I have a date coming, Bruce Wayne. And so he said no, and he leaves. So then after he leaves, you get her thoughts, and she does know that he's Batman, but she just doesn't know how to kind of broach the subject. So anyhow, Bruce ends up calling her after leaving and says that he's running just a little late, and they decide to cancel the date. So then you get into the meat of the story where Batman is called down by some fishermen that reveal their catch for the day, and all of the fish have Joker face grins. And the fisherman says that all of his, you know, that the fishermen up and down the coast are all reporting the same thing. And, so Batman promises, to look into it. The next thing that happens is we cut to, the city hall in Gotham City, and, Joker and his gang, come in and, to have a talk to the copyright commissioner. And, what the Joker would like him to do is file a copyright for those fish. And, he says, you know, we're going up and down the coast. They're on the East Coast, the West Coast. All these fish, they're all going to have these Joker faces. So I want to copyright that, and then I'll get a cut of every fish sale in America. And he's saying he's going to get a nickel per fish sandwich, 50 cents for a fillet of sole. And so the commissioner says that that's impossible. You can't copyright fish. And so, of course, Joker's very, very angry to hear this, and says that he has until midnight to get this to happen. Otherwise, he's the commissioner is going to be dead as a mackerel. So, I don't know if I know that the Joker's insane, but that seems kind of that he also must be stupid. But as I'm reading, I'm like, he's going to copyright fish. Very, very crazy. But then there's a brief little interlude with Rupert Thorne that there had been a story happening in issues past where he had he thought he had Hugo Strange killed, but he's been seeing Hugo Strange's ghost. Him and Joker have a run-in in the bathroom, and Joker kind of admonishes Rupert Thorne to leave Batman alone, because if anyone's going to be destroying Batman, it's going to be Joker and not anyone else. So he said that he doesn't want Rupert Thorne to even get in Batman's business. That drives Rupert Thorne just crazy. He goes running out and gets in his car and starts driving away. Batman then later in that evening, it's the following day from when he saw those Joker fish, he gets a call from Commissioner Gordon, and he says, you know, we've got a problem. We need to protect this man, and he points to the copyright commissioner. And so Batman, along with all of the cops, go ahead and they lock down the building that the copyright commissioner's in. They have everything guarded. Batman's already checked everything. He's made sure that the guy hasn't eaten anything recently, make sure that any water that he's been drinking is has been tested before he drinks it, so on and so forth. So suddenly it becomes midnight and gas starts coming up from the heating ducts. He quickly tries to put a gas mask on the commissioner's face, but as it strikes the 12 strikes of midnight, the commissioner, the copyright commissioner, that is, falls over with a, you know, hideous grimace on his face, and nobody else is affected, including like Commissioner Gordon, who didn't even have, just covering his mouth with a like a cloth. And so what they find out is that there was a two-part thing to this gas, and the Joker must have doused the copyright commissioner with the first part, and when it reacts to the second, it causes him to die, and so that's why everyone else wasn't affected. Excuse me. So then Joker gets on the TV, on all TVs, and says that he still doesn't have what he wants, his legal claim to the new improved Joker fish, and if it doesn't change by 3 a.m., the number two bureaucrat will be in trouble next. So obviously Batman and Commissioner Gordon still have some work to do. Rupert Thorne is continuing to drive out of the city to get away from what's going on in Gotham, and he stops at the side of the road because there's a woman by a broken down car, asking people to stop, and Rupert stops, and it's Silver St. Clair that also is trying to leave the city as well. She jumps in the car with him, and they drive away. And that is the end of the issue. So as you can guess, this is continued in the next issue, which I have not read yet. I do have 476, and I'm sure it's probably on the DC Universe app as well. So I'll have to take a look to see how this story ends. But this was good. I failed to say who the creative team is. So let me just pull this back out because, it's one of just beautiful art. Steve Englehart is the writer and Marshall Rogers is, the artist. And Chris, I mean, this is like the classic, like 80s, late 70s, 80s depiction of the Joker. You know, those, like, if you see t-shirts or magnets or buttons or whatever of that, you know, of the Joker in kind of that retro style, this is kind of how it looks.
Yeah.
And it, absolutely gorgeous, drawing. And Batman looks amazing. He draws, Silver St. Clair absolutely beautifully. Marshall Rogers, he was amazing.
Yeah, I know people. I hear people on podcasts talking a lot about the Marshall Rogers Batman.
Definitely. Yeah, and I don't think I've read a ton of his issues, but this one, wow, it just absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, there's quite a few. I feel like there's quite a few iconic stories in his run there.
Yeah.
But what a bizarre. I can't imagine that there's too many comics in which a copyright commissioner is threatened.
Right, that's the point of the whole story, is that's what he wants, to have a copyright on something that something as ridiculous as fish.
What's the business plan there? I mean, the Joker fish—they're not safe to eat, right?
I mean, that's the question too, right? I mean, I can't imagine anyone would want to eat that fish, even if you can't get it from devouring it. I can't imagine anyone was going to want to eat fish that looked like that.
No.
But let's appetizing. Say that they did. How does this get set up that this money is somehow legally funneled to to the Joker because people are her catching the fish. I don't know how any of that works, but again, he's insane. So
yeah, what are you protecting there exactly? Like other other criminals from using your scheme,
right? it was a lot of fun though to read. I have to say it was great, and I am looking at this this run, and Steve Englehart had a very short run. But Marshall Rogers continued with some of the art when Len Wayne started writing as well a little while after that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, good stuff. I had a great time reading this.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's these are all on DC Universe.
Oh, that's great to know.
Of comics issues. Yeah, it looks like a pretty... I don't know exactly what the numbers of Rogers' time on the title was, but it seems like there's a pretty... There isn't really any gaps anywhere near that issue, so...
Yeah, I'm only seeing here, just in this... Maybe he did it, you know, before or after as well, but I'm seeing, like, the late 460s and going up through... really only like 479, so wasn't a huge amount.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he did it before that as well, and I'm just not seeing that part of the run yet, but yeah. So what do you have?
Well, nothing out of the norm for me as of late. I have been for several months now reading comics pretty consistently, but it's all just been DC in the 80s pretty much across the board for me. Earlier in the year I read a few issues of some Marvel stuff, but I pretty much have just been each night before bed I read a couple issues of on the DC Universe app, and that's pretty much been my comic reading, and I've been proceeding as if I live in this little world where these are the new DC comics that are coming out.
Nice.
Reading them in order, like they're getting my digital pull list or something like that.
Yeah.
And you know, I had started this project a while ago, but then left it off. So I'm not as far into the project as it would be if I had just been doing this all along since when I originally started it years ago. But I have reached Millennium, which has been interesting. I don't know if I'm actually going to talk about a Millennium issue, but I just wanted to comment on that just because I had read Millennium as an event. I think I even talked about it on this podcast years ago where I just read the event and wasn't super impressed with it. And so it's interesting to hit that again, but be reading it as it came out with the other tie-in issues.
Yeah.
I don't think that it's ultimately going to improve my opinion of it.
I don't remember a lot about this particular event. I read it when it came out.
Yeah, I mean, do you remember the basic...
No, I don't... Like, what was the basic idea of it?
The basic...
I know it was after Crisis, right?
Yeah, it was after Crisis and Legends.
Okay.
You know, Crisis kind of was one of those first, along with Secret Wars, one of those first... big summer events that persist to this day in comics. And its success kind of led to diminished returns, generally speaking, Legends was still decent. But you know, with Millennium, it was 8 weeks and each week had four or five books that crossed it over with it. And they just, one of the things that was good about Crisis is that the ground was laid. I mean, it wasn't perfect. There were things that changed as they went along, whether it's the nature of the monitor and what his goals were. And it seemed like some internal communication problems that led to some inconsistencies in what people were putting out there. But generally speaking, and the ground was laid for that event for several years. And I think the editors at the time had the patience for that because there wasn't this tested... The event of that side hadn't been tested before, and so it wasn't... They didn't know that it was necessarily going to be a success. But then if you keep wanting to repeat that, you don't have the same amount of time to lay the groundwork, you know?
Right, yeah.
I mean, it since has been done a little bit better, but I think in the case of Millennium, they just kind of, they wanted the revelation of, well, so the basic premise is that the Guardians of the Galaxy and their female counterparts, I think it's Zamorans or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, Zamorans.
Show up on Earth, and they plan to create a new group of immortals from like 10 people on Earth as new like global guardians, and the actual global guardians are disbanded sort of in the background kind of, but and meanwhile the Manhunters that they created prior to the Green Lantern Corps are opposing them and trying to put a stop to them creating these new granting this new immortal status to these immortals.
Is this the one where the Manhunters were like various
There's like
people
so
in the
okay. sleeper agents. Yeah, so that's
the aspect okay.
of it that
I remember
feels
that
kind
part.
Of forced. Yeah, because that was kind of what one of the things that they seems sort of in sensational and not really earned in some respects. Some worse than others, but you have like in Flash, you have Wally West's father revealing that he's a sleeper agent. I mean, I have mixed feelings about that one because prior, like in the Silver and Bronze Age, like Wally's parents were kind of non-entities. I mean, they showed up occasionally here and there in the Silver Age, but they never had really any personalities other than just generic parents, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But you had like Lana Lang in Superman, Detective Gordon in Batman, and with some of these they obviously had to make them like replacements, like body doubles or something like that, rather than permanently remove James Gordon from, you know, Gotham City or
right.
things like that, but so it comes off a little bit cheap, in my opinion. But that's where I'm at. So far, I'm like about 3 months into Millennium. I still think like kind of a lesser event in the scheme of things.
Yeah.
But some titles handle the intrusion a little bit better than others. And in some cases, the character that is revealed to be a Manhunter is not as consequential to the hero's background, you know, as, say, James Gordon. But I'm also reaching a point that a lot of titles are ending, which is interesting. Like, Outsiders is close to wrapping up. Blue Beetle, Booster Gold, the Hawkman series, which was kind of just, I assume, just kind of let continue while they focused on more characters that were more popular and more important, like figured out what they were going to do with Superman and Wonder Woman, Batman and stuff, and Flash post-crisis. Because people, I think, sort of forget about this series. It ran for 17 issues, started before Crisis, and was a pretty traditional take on Hawkman and Hawkgirl. At least, you know, it pulled from the Silver Age a lot. And people think, you know, post-Crisis, the first thing that was really done with Hawkman was like Hawk World,
yeah,
and that kind of thing. And I think they just let this title go on for a little while until they got around to figure out what they were going to attempt to do with Hawkman anyways, post-crisis. So that's kind of interesting in seeing what new titles are come up to replace those. And some of the things that are kind of that are pulled into Millennium are interesting, because Legion of Superheroes has issues that are has at least two issues that tie into, well, probably wouldn't be, it wouldn't be any more than two, yeah, so two issues that tie in with Laurel Kent, which is a character that in the future claimed to be a descendant of Clark Kent. She turns out to be a Manhunter. And it definitely takes some juggling to explain why is this occurring at the point that it is in the future. Because it's kind of, you know, like, it's the future of the universe, so it's not, you know, concurrent with what's happening chronologically with what's happening in the present,
yes,
universe.
Yeah.
Like, whenever
that
they,
always confused me.
Yeah, when
they happens a lot in movies and stuff too.
Yeah, they're trying to pull in, how do they pull in, how do they bring the Legion of Superheroes into a crossover?
Right.
Is always kind of a challenge and stuff. And another one, I think you may have read this recently, which, so I'll actually get into talking about an issue here, was Young All-Stars.
Yeah, I've been reading. I had been a bit, yeah, of that, yeah.
I know you read this run recently, and that, so issue number 8 came out in the second week of Millennium, was and so this obviously takes place in the past. But what I did think was interesting and was well done about it was that Roy Thomas latched onto the fact that they're using the Manhunters in this crossover, and the Manhunter concept within DC is one that actually has a long history. Roy Thomas was also writing Secret Origin at this time, which was a post-crisis new title. And the issue that also came out this same week was an issue that went into the history of the various Manhunter characters at DC. So the very first page of this issue shows two different heroes going by the name of Manhunter. So he takes two of those characters in the comic book history and brings them together. One, Paul Kirk, has a costume that matches the robot Manhunters that the Guardians of the Galaxy created. But then there's also Dan Richards, who wears a pretty much all blue costume with a blue domino mask. And both characters are transported simultaneously from separate locations before the Grandmaster, who's a character that always had a connection to the, and is a part of Manhunter lore. And so the way that Thomas writes it is the two Manhunters have sort of a, they're a little irritated with each other, so that's kind of how he posits the whole them having the same name, is that they're aware of each other and not happy about the fact. speaking of copyrights, you know, they I guess don't have that option, are trying to protect their public image. But they don't realize at first that they've both been transported from where they were at to the same location, so they both assume that they're in the same place that they came from. And they're like, why are you're... So they're upset with each other for not staying on their own turf until the Grandmaster reveals what's going on. I'm just going to call him the Blue Manhunter as opposed to the red one. Has a dog named Thor that fights with him. And we see that he doesn't realize that the dog is robotic, or at least has some way of like having this robotic like eye that's recording everything that goes on, and that Dan Richards doesn't realize that this is the case. But he was given this dog by the Grandmaster. So once they understand that they were teleported there, he of course wants them to join forces to go up against the same enemy. He said, I'm going to show you your enemy's identity, and you're going to see why I need you to work together. Why, not only that, but I'm going to need you to get additional help. We see their reaction to being shown this image and their shock. Not who they are, not the image that they're shown, but they're told that they have to defeat him for the good of mankind and to ensure that the United Nations are triumphant over the Axis powers. And we'll flip the page, and it's a full page reveal of a poster of the Alan Scott Green Lantern advertising war bonds. So that's kind of like the prologue, the opening and stuff. Then the next scene we go to is Iron Monroe and Flying Fox, who, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe, I don't know if these are original characters or characters that he found, but I think he kind of brought them in to represent Superman and Batman, or kind of not represent them, but take their place. And
yeah, he definitely created them.
Okay. Yeah, so I think that was the intention. Like, they're not the same as those two characters, but they are brought in to sort of fill that void created by the changes to history from Crisis.
Right.
So there's some kind of character building here as they get to know each other. They're not very familiar with each other at this point, and we don't know a lot about their backgrounds. They're very different from each other, and they're trying to relate to each other, and it's pretty good character development. Flying Fox can obviously fly, whereas Iron Monroe does the like early Golden Age Superman kind of thing of of just really, really big jumps.
Yep.
But they show up at headquarters and reconnect with a couple of other members of the Young All-Stars. Are kind of a group within a group of the All-Star Squadron. They meet up with Fury and what's his name? Dynamite, right?
Oh yeah. Yep.
And Dynamite's showing Fury some things on using the their like communication screen, and it shows them like where different members of the All-Star Squadron are located right now on a map, what they're doing and stuff, and Iron Monroe goes and he goes to make a call to his mother, which is less like a result of that conversation they had with Flying Fox, and he not realizing that he could maybe use the phone at the headquarters to communicate, make that long distance call, which takes you back. not something that was so easily done in this time period.
Very true.
So there's a little bit more of like team building and stuff like that with some of the other members in the All-Star Squadron. Then eventually the two Manhunters show up with Doibie Dickles, which was the very interesting Green Lantern sidekick in the Golden Age. And this is where it's communicated that something's going on with Alan Scott, because he actually attacked a U.S. base in the Hawaiian Islands. Flew off with a Japanese prisoner of war. They want the young All-Stars' help. Well, you know, they show up looking for just any help from the All-Star Squadron. It's the only people that are there are members of the young All-Stars, and they want to track down Green Lantern and figure out what's going on with him. Doibie, as his friend, is pretty much convinced something's wrong with him, that he's not truly a traitor. And the only kind of clue that they have is a piece of paper that Green Lantern left behind that they recognize as some kind of possibly some kind of latitude and longitude. So they use that, but there's sort of an interesting thing which I don't think is explained in this issue, probably in the next issue. When everyone leaves and Doibie's the only one that's left there, it's kind of like all of his skin and muscle and everything like that disintegrates, and it looks like there's a robot underneath.
I remember this now.
Yeah, and then the robot itself ultimately disintegrates as well. It's just like a steaming pile of liquid on the ground.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a surprise. The group, the Manhunters and the All-Stars, they get on a ship flown by Hop Harrigan we see that a group of seems like native people. I don't know if they're still in America or if they're like farther
north. Oh, I think they're in Canada, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, I want to say it's even farther north, I think, into Canada. Still of the native peoples. The Lantern is using his powers to create the appearance of their one of their gods, so the people are fleeing what they think is the rage of their god, that's what's basically going on when the All-Stars arrive and try to put a stop to this. And it's not... Flying Fox hits Green Lantern with a big log. I'm not sure if he is aware of... Yeah, it doesn't look like he was aware of the ring's weakness to wood. He just happened to grab it because it was on the ground there and used it to hit him with. But then he tries to take off the Lantern's ring and it kind of self-defense. Seems to have almost kind of like a self-defense mechanism and knocks Flying Fox out. So, but whatever, for a moment there at least, Alan Scott seems to be himself again. He looks around, he sees the knocked out bodies of all the other heroes, and he's like, did I do that to all these poor kids? and he's like, can't seem to remember, but then it's almost as if something is up with his ring, because his ring is glowing, and all of a sudden it seems as if whatever is wrong with him clicks back into place, because he says he remembers, and he's got a triple mission to carry out, and nothing can stand in the way, no matter who gets hurt, and he takes off. So yeah, that seems to be like a two-parter, you know, because that fits into the 2 months that the event ran, and a lot of what will be explained in the next issue. But I thought it was, you know, without seeing how things resolve in the next issue, I thought it did a good job of being somewhat related to the series, in that you know, there's a connection to the Manhunter history there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what would be satisfying, like if you read at the time, if you wanted something that like really reflected and furthered the events of the main crossover, if it would be satisfying in that respect. But if you were reading Young All-Stars and just wanted a continuation of that book, and didn't want it to feel too interrupted, like, I think it would be satisfying. So I thought it kind of struck a decent balance of those things.
Yeah, I remember, you know, when I was reading this, I did enjoy it, the series, quite a bit. I had read All-Star Squadron just prior to this.
Mm-hmm.
Because as All-Star Squadron was wrapping up, he kept making reference to the new volume of All-Star Squadron. I'm like, well, I wonder why that never happened. I wonder why. Then it was like the last issue, and they're like, all right, it's coming. It's going to be called something different. It's the Young All-Stars. I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
It seemed like, I don't know if plans changed, because Roy Thomas kind of like all along was kind of indicating that it was going to be a different series, but it was going to still focus on a lot of those of the main All-Star Squadron group, and what I mean by that is like Amazing Man, Liberty Bell, Johnny Quick,
mm-hmm.
Tarantula, and Firebrand. So the yeah. ones that really never had a home anywhere else. And it quickly, Young All-Stars quickly evolved to, no, it's just going to be about these, and obviously by the title, I think that they made that decision before it was published, but it seems like they made the decision, let's focus on a new young set, you know, set of people instead of the other ones that had been around.
Yeah.
But it was interesting. I liked the series.
Yeah, as it goes on, and as he develops the new characters more, I find myself connecting with it more. I still don't think, like, design-wise, the new characters are quite as iconic.
No, you're right.
As those that he focused on in the All-Star Squadron. But as he fleshes them out more, they become a little more interesting. Like this issue, Iron Monroe seemed a little more interesting. But I think my favorite thing about the series so far was the way that it dealt with prior to this with Tsunami and the Japanese camps.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was good, wasn't it?
That was really interesting. Yeah, I thought that was probably the best bit storyline so far. That sort of her struggling with that, and the way that it addresses just her character and some of the, like Dynamite, I think in particular, he is like the youngest of the young, and also dealing with the death of his mentor and stuff, but he's at first pretty racist against her for being Japanese and pretty suspicious of her as of being a traitor, even though she's Japanese American. So I do think it's interesting that he was dealing with not shying away from dealing with that, those aspects of the time period.
Especially when this came out in the, you know, mid to late 80s, mm-hmm. 80, you know, 87 and stuff. You didn't hear, like, I don't know, me personally, like, I didn't really know or hear anything about the fact that we put Japanese and Japanese Americans behind barbed wire. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't mm-hmm. hear that. Like, you don't learn that in school about when they talk about World War II. At least they, not when I was in school.
Right.
So yeah, I'm glad that he was, you know, hitting it straight on and like balancing the fact that like FDR was, you know, seen as a very powerful, strong, and great leader during World War II, and yet he was in real life, like he knew that this was happening. He signed off on it. You know what I mean? And it's like not everyone is you know a perfect person, or I should say nobody is a perfect person.
Right.
But it was nice to see different aspects of individuals, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, because when this came out, we were, especially you being a little bit older, would have been at the age where you would have been learning about this, and, myself as well, when we learned about World War II, it was pretty much, we're the good guys and they were the bad guys. And
yeah,
I mean it's easy to when the bad guys include the Nazis, like that's pretty easy to do.
Yeah.
You know, because yeah. Like
it is. It is.
Most, you know, it's easy to look good if you compare yourself to Nazis, but like,
well, but most wars are more nuanced than World War II.
Yeah. Yeah. And the point being that even World War II, there was nuance, you know.
Yeah.
We weren't
innocent of any wrongdoing, by any means.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So things like this, yeah, it's cool to see that there. It was interesting the way the Tsunami character. She's definitely interesting in that regard. So
yeah, very. I'm glad you enjoyed it. The next one I've got is pulled this one out of a box today and figured I just a little bit not in depth by any means. It's a Weird War Tales number 78 from 1979. So we've got a handful of stories here.
And the first one is set in the future, and even a young kid should be able to understand the parallels here and what they're talking about. So it's set in the future, they're gonna basically there's a particular area, particular colony out in space, to Earth or from Earth, they're sending out some armed forces through spaceships to push back against an insurrection happening. And what you learn as you're reading the story is that the Earth is going going to different solar systems and so forth, finding inhabitable land, relocating the natives that live on that inhabitable land to somewhere else, and taking over that land for themselves. Seems like some people, some of these aliens take exception from being physically removed from the land that they have always lived on. And so they came and so that they're coming to kind of put a stop to it. Now, one of the officers has some second thoughts about this because he's just like, we're just displacing aliens off their planets and we're just pushing pushing the galactic frontier further and further. That's what he says. However, his commanding officer doesn't want to hear about that. And the lower officer goes on to say that, you know, they siphoned resources and food supplies, but they're still meeting fierce resistance. But they've never actually seen these aliens. They're from Antares. And the commanding officer says, well, that doesn't really make a difference because we can't see them, but we can see their villages. So we're going to target their villages. So they go and they destroy village after village after village until basically the entire planet is wiped out. However, in this burning disaster of a planet, you see these Antarans just rising as skeletons from the Earth, blood still pooling on the ground from all of them dying, and wiping their skulls with their own blood to form a macabre type of war paint. They even get on horses that have bat wings, and they have energy bows and arrows and energy spears, and they fly off into space, and they start attacking the spaceships, and sure enough totally destroy the spaceships entirely. The under commander throws his gun down, says he's not killing anymore, and you know, what have we done? And he gets arrowed in the back and dies. The commanding officer it won't go down, says they won't get him, and he gets shot in the shoulder and then becomes just overwhelmed by these skeletal creatures. So obviously this is a very not subtle parallel to our history of not just coming to America, but more specifically as a nation, United States, constantly pushing Native Americans farther and farther west as we kept developing land in the United States. So, but it was a good short story. Like I said, obvious what the writer was getting at here, and actually there are credits for these. This was written by Michael Uslan and art by Romeo Tangal. The next story is very short, just a couple pages, and it's got a bunch of soldiers hunkered down behind a ridge, and there's a fox. No, what do they call that? What do they call the little like bunker where the enemy will shoot like a machine gun from? That you kind of have to like sneak up around and like throw a grenade into to keep them from shooting anymore. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. So you don't think it's Foxhole?
I don't know. Is it? I don't. Maybe it is. But anyhow, that's what the enemy's in. They're shooting off his machine gun left and right, and these five or six soldiers are pinned down, and the one calls out to the fellow soldier, Eddie, you got to get that machine gun. And you want to see? He says, "Why me? It's always me, Sarge." And they're like, "Why? Because you're the best at nailing machine gun nests." That's an order, soldier. So he's crawling on his, you know, on his stomach, getting as low as possible, slithering through the dirt, trying to do it. He actually crawls into a patch of briars, to thinking that, you know, they'll never suspect that he's crawling through that stuff. And he gets closer and closer and close enough to toss his grenade. He throws his grenade into the hole just as the machine gun tears him apart. The machine gun nest gets blown up, and then the rest of the troops, the three or four other soldiers, get up. And the one soldier says, "Oh, Eddie finally bought it. Maybe we shouldn't have sent him this one more time, huh, Sarge?" And he says, "Oh, poor guy." And then he says, "Ah, forget it. He was only human." And then look, and all the rest of them are robots. So that's why this was a weird war tale, because they sent the human, so none of the robots got injured. And then the last story is set in Vietnam War. It's called, and let me go back. That story was by Bob Haney and Juan Ortiz. This last one set in Vietnam called The Tunnels is by Bill Kelly and art by Dick Ayers. So what's going on here is we've got a group of American soldiers and somebody they're waiting for somebody to come back, one of their scouts to come back. But what we see is that they were grabbed from behind and dragged into an opening in the ground that was then covered up. And so the rest of the troops are, you know, saying, you know, he's still not back. He's been gone for an hour. And the sergeant says, you know, he's probably never made it past the tunnels. So the rest of the troops don't know about the tunnels. And he's like, yeah, there's a network of them dug out and all over the place. And they pop up and they grab people and close it back up. Like, but we've got our orders. We've got our advance. So this one soldier by the name of Adams, isn't moving. He's like, come on, we got to go. And Adams, he's like, they're going to kill us all. I'm getting out of here. So he goes and, runs away. And he's like, I'm not going to die like the others. And he hears shooting then behind him. And as he's running off, he hears that the shooting stopped. And he's like, they must have gotten them all. And when I get back to base, I'll tell them I was the only survivor. As he's bursting through the underbrush, he sees a Viet Cong, and the Viet Cong lunges at him with a knife. But he knocks him with the butt of his rifle. And is about to shoot him when the Viet Cong says not to, because he can make him rich. And he says he's a servant of Mi Nang, and that his religion teaches many things, and that if he spares him, that he'll give him great wealth. So he says that the wealth is a few hundred feet away, jewels hidden in tunnels. And the soldier's like, are you crazy? I don't believe you. You're going to butcher me as soon as I set foot in there. He's like, no, put the sacred amulet on and you'll be safe from the guns of our soldiers. And I'll go with you. I'll go in first. You can shoot me. You'll be able to shoot me before you're attacked if I'm lying. So sure enough, they crawl down into this huge. Now these tunnels are massive. They look ancient and huge. They go past a couple of Viet Cong soldiers that are startled to see an American there, but they stop themselves and actually comment that he's wearing the sacred amulet and that he's allowed to pass. So they keep going, keep going, keep going. And in the distance, the soldier can hear people like chanting, praying farther off. But they keep going, and sure enough, there's this big cavern with all of these priceless gems, jewels, gold, everything. So he's like, I can't believe this. And he turns around, and he ends up shooting and killing the Viet Cong regardless, saying, now I don't have to worry about you while I'm filling my pockets. He stuffs as much gold as he can. He's like, okay, now which way was the way out of here? And he's backtracking, going forward, figuring out he's going the wrong way, turns around. He keeps going around and around, trying to figure out where he is. And he's like, I'm lost. And like, this is like a maze in mythology. And, he comes up to a turn, and there's a couple of Viet Cong in robes, and they see he's got the amulet, and they say he's the chosen one, and they grab him, and, they tie him up and march him, into where everyone was chanting, Mi Nang, Mi Nang, Ming Nang. And, the soldier gets thrown into this pit, and there's this huge, an Asian style minotaur. And that's actually what he's thinking. He's like, Adams remembers the maze was used in ancient mythology. And then he remembers what was found deep within it. And he realizes that Min Nang is an oriental deviation of Minotaur, and he's thrown into that. So that's the end of the tale. He meets his doom. So these are fun stories. I always like reading, whether it's Unexpected or House of Mystery, Weird War Tales. I like these anthologies that they used to do in the 70s and 80s. So yeah, that was that one.
Yeah, I was looking to see if doesn't look like there's any Weird War Tales on DC Universe, unfortunately.
Oh, that's too bad. They should definitely add some of those. They're fun.
Yeah, it's a interesting title, because it's that combination of a war story with some aspect of like science fiction or fantasy or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where Creature Commandos came out of and stuff.
And I was just gonna say, like the earlier issues, like you know this one up to this one was number 78. These were basically, they were a lot more just, standard, anthology stories. But yeah, later on, as it got farther into the run, we got some kind of recurring stories, and it was, either the Creature Commandos or then the G.I. Robot, came around. So they started playing around with some ongoing stories as well, which was a lot of fun. That's actually with the age that I'm at, that's where I kind of encountered Weird War Tales for the first time on the news rack is they were deep into their Creature Commandos, run. It was actually, like it would say Weird War Tales up at the top in smaller writing, and it would say, starring the Creature Commandos, and that was the big headline on the actual cover. So, and as a little kid, you almost think that the name of the comic is Creature Commandos because you don't notice the Weird War Tales at the top. But, I love these. They're a lot of fun.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it doesn't seem like a lot of those anthology titles are on DC Universe, but, I mean, they do continue to add stuff, so.
Yeah, which is nice.
Speaking of them adding stuff, I'll talk about The Spectre.
Okay.
Issue number 9. So from the same time period, this is not a Millennium crossover issue, although it looks like the next issue is. But yeah, this is a post-crisis.
You said issue 9?
Yeah.
Okay.
Spectre series is really,
yep,
really good.
Yep, I got it.
It's been written by Doug Mensch from the beginning, pretty much. Or not pretty much, it has been. but the artist on this issue, for the first time, is Gray Morrow. Really, really good choice for the title and stylistically. And it's also got a cover. I think some of the previous covers, if not all of them, were also Mike Mignola.
Interesting.
Really cool cover, but so yeah, it starts out with a naked Madame Xanadu writhing around in bed.
Oh my goodness.
but with narration though, from I just had a mind fart of my mind keeps wanting to say Corrigan. C's men with last names that start with C in the dark corners of the DC universe mixed up, and I kept wanting to say Constantine. There's narration from Jim Corrigan, the host of the Spectre. The Spectre kind of talking about how the Spectre has tried to explain to him some aspects of their relation, the consciousness of, between the two of them, and kind of a from a point of view of kind of a physics sort of explanation, that he's wondering if he was kind of doing so to sort of appeal to the rational side of his mind. Says the intent of consciousness is also everywhere. Corrigan's ignorance comes from the fact that his mind is asleep. Any consciousness truly aware of itself would supposedly be aware of other consciousnesses here, there, and everywhere. That these consciousnesses could perceive intentions, sort of like a scientific explanation for ambiance. And it turns out he's kind of explaining this to this woman, Kimmy, that has been one of the supporting characters that's kind of in a relationship with him. Ultimately what it comes down to is that the Spectre's out there waiting for someone's to read someone's intentions, one of the things that's kind of been going on in the title to this point is this kind of examination of is what the Spectre does just, and Corrigan struggling with what the Spectre does. The Spectre, we get like a little bit of a flashback from several hours earlier when the Spectre leaves his body and Corrigan asks him where he's off to. And it seems like the Spectre, even though he's less powerful than he used to be, he's got this intention to sort of strike before the crime is committed, not wait and avenge a crime, but to punish the...
Oh, yeah, proactive.
So proactive vengeance, yeah. And that's kind of what the whole, like, thing that he was describing to Kimmy was resulting from, that their conversation about this, that Spectre claiming that he can actually read some kind of, like, on some conscious level of the consciousness mind prior to the crime being committed. And throughout we get, like, we keep checking in on these, like, little vignettes. There's a woman who whose husband has just come home smelling of another woman and is rude to her, and goes to bed, and she's still awake, and she's drinking, and she's contemplating killing him. And then we also see, like, a young man who's, like, working at the family grocery, he never took the money in the register to the bank, and 'cause they were so busy, and his, he said he'll just take it to his apartment and take it to the bank in the morning. It's just like, you're gonna walk the streets with that much money. And we see someone, like, on the streets kind of lurking. When he does actually leave to go home that night, he's like, yeah, you know, mom's kind of spooked me. I'm actually a little, this is a lot of dough to be carrying. Kimmy and Jim continue to have their conversation about his feelings about being a host to the Spectre and the fact that he can't control the Spectre. He's not at this point a cop anymore, and he doesn't want to be a cop because of the amount of rules. But he's wrestling with where to draw the line, kind of, as that his feelings about being on the force relate to his what the Spectre does. And so, yeah, we see then the Spectre encounter these scenarios that have been seeded earlier, where a man is approaching the supermarket guy with all the money. He's pulling out a gun and kind of approach a guy from the behind. All of a sudden, he gets lost in a fog. The Spectre starts choking him through the fog, and breaks apart the gun, dissipates when he's lying on the ground suffocated. A woman decides finally to go into the bedroom with a knife, but as she does grab the doorknob to the bedroom, it transforms into this reptilian sort of dragon-like mouth and starts grabbing her hands, and so she starts slashing at what she thinks is grabbing her hand, but she's actually, like, slashing into her own arm. She wakes up her husband, and she's like, what are you doing? There's a fog in the apartment. There's a third incident, and then finally, the next morning, or it's actually kind of late, but when Corrigan finally gets out of bed, he turns on the radio and hears a report of a number of strange occurrences around Greenwich Village, along with the strange mist that was noticed throughout the area, and it's enough that he's kind of getting suspicious because he knows that the Spectre had left him prior to all this happening. So he calls Kimmy, which I think she's actually his his secretary for his freelance detective agency and stuff, but it's developed into a romantic relationship. So he asks her to put her shoes on. They go out and hit the street. And he wants to try to, I think he wants to try to find the Spectre. He's sure at this point that Spectre's using his body as some kind of, he calls it headquarters for Hell Central. He feels like it is on his conscience that what the Spectre's doing. He feels like the medicine's worse than the disease when it comes to the Spectre, killing people before they've even committed the crime. But the Spectre's been, at this point, gone longer. Alright, this is what his intention was. So they check into a hotel, and then Kimmy finally figures out Corrigan is actually trying to hide from the Spectre to try to stop him. He's trying to hide himself as the host so that the Spectre can't find its way back to him, which they both need to survive. So basically he's attempting to sacrifice himself. Use the fact that the Spectre is kind of distracted by his new approach. But Kimmy doesn't want to let him sacrifice himself. She doesn't feel like this is the right way to go about this, and so she gets on the phone to call Madame Xanadu, who's been also kind of a supporting character in this run, to do something about this. And while she's doing that, he runs out of the hotel room that they're in, hits the street. We finally see there was a connection of some sort between what the Spectre was doing and the mist that was covering the area, and Madame Xanadu writhing around in bed. The Spectre shows up in her room and talks about how the seduction of power, how it was luring him, showing him glimpses of giving him little tastes of the omnipotence that he used to have, but all the while actually killing him, as he was just sort of in this kind of mist form and linked to all these different minds and their thoughts, and feeling like he was had power over it. It almost led to him staying out there until it was too late for him. His heart, even though he's sort of taken a form that she can recognize, he's barely holding himself together. And it's been it's been 2 days, and it's been about as long as he can still survive being apart from Corrigan. and it's not 100% clear, but there was some kind of that whole thing with her was somehow connected to what he was doing, like the there was some kind of, she calls it a dark thing that they shared, not without its reward and pleasures. He heads out to try to find Corrigan and sees Kim. He asks her where Corrigan is at, but she's lost him, of course. The Spectre is able to track him down by Corrigan's intentions to kill. Since Corrigan intends to kill the Spectre by what he's doing, the Spectre is able to use that as a way of locating him. Now that he knows what is going on. And they have an exchange that sort of follows up on, you know, like, why is Corrigan attempting to do this? And the Spectre says, you know, I'm only doing what you did for years as a cop, and even now as a private investigator. Corrigan replies, you know, when did I ever give anybody a heart attack or make somebody drop dead from sheer fright? So yeah, I mean, it's ultimately like a discussion again about, like, is it better to wait until the murderer has actually killed, or not? And it's a question he has trouble answering. He doesn't want to go back to being a cop. He doesn't want to be caught up in those rules the rules that don't have a meaning, but he feels like there should be some rules. You know, he said, well, you need at least some proof of wrongdoing. And the Spectre claims that he can, he has the proof in every atom of their mind and their beings. And just because Corrigan's mind isn't, capable of that, isn't capable of perceiving the proof until it's too late, until the crime's already committed. You know, and Spectre just says, you have to trust me that I know, and that's not enough for Corrigan. He said, well, if I didn't have that power, if I couldn't perceive his intent, you know, if I couldn't perceive your intent to kill me, then how could he have found him in the thousands of alleyways in the city? You know, that point is enough to make Corrigan pause and allow him to reconnect. But it does end with him, with Corrigan thanking Kim for saving his life and not allowing him to sacrifice himself to kill the Spectre. So I thought it was a really good issue. Just it doesn't really present a solution, but explores that issue and makes you think about it, and definitely explores like the unique circumstances of that Corrigan finds himself in really well. And because that wasn't 100% clear on what was clearly, I don't know if the Spectre, that connection that with Madame Xanadu was allowing him to was enhancing his power, or was allowing him to remain separated from Corrigan longer. There was some kind of connection there where she was receiving like a physical pleasure from being connected, and he was benefiting in some way from it too. So it's sort of an interesting subplot there, just kind of like a sort of reflects like back on the larger issue of going on the issue, but overall I thought it was really well done.
Cool. Yeah, you're enjoying the series as a whole?
Yeah, I like it a lot so far. I like, it's interesting, this, it seems like for a while this question and Suicide Squad were coming out like on the same day.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a really, that's a really powerful like lineup there. But yeah, I like these, even though part of this reading project is to see the connections and the different books, I do kind of like these darker series that were going on, The Question, Spectre. They, it was an interesting time in the series, you know, or in comics, because DC was definitely exploring with like more mature reader books, you know, and this was actually right around the time that Hellblazer number one came out, and they didn't yet have the Vertigo line. You know, there was a number of books that ended up being moved over to Vertigo, and sort of separated a little bit more directly, but yeah, it's interesting to see that kind of, I think probably the influence of like the what existed of like an independent comics scene sort of coming in, and DC and Marvel kind of, but DC especially at this time, finding a way to sort of attract that market themselves.
Yeah, for sure.
So
that's cool.
Good stuff.
The only other thing that I have is, and I'm not necessarily going to like go through a whole synopsis of it, but just a couple movies that I've watched.
Uh-huh.
On Friday we put on Superman the movie from 1978 with the kids.
Oh.
I haven't seen that. Chris, I couldn't even tell you how many. I mean, I've seen it on cable or whatever, but I mean, it's got to be at least been 30 years at least. So I was impressed again, like in thinking of, you know, when it was out in 1978 and really was kind of like the first mainstream superhero movie. I don't know. I found it in endearing, just the way that they kind of portrayed, you know, the Superman as that kind of like force for good, and the whole take, you know, that Christopher Reeves did with his you know, as Clark Kent. And, you know, just bumbling and so, I mean, it, some people might not appreciate it, but like I found it just very nice for a comedic effect, and just I don't know, I really enjoyed that. I had not remembered that it showed those showed Zod and his two his two buddies at the beginning of the first movie. I had forgotten that they even had a part in there, because they show them being sent to the Phantom Zone. And, so we watched with the kids, and both of them, but particularly Allie, doesn't handle any type of suspense well at all. So when I think of that movie, I think of it as a pretty benign movie, but like anything is going to happen, she gets very freaked out. So like I was never like that as a kid for watching movies. I was watching like the big monster movies like Godzilla and stuff like that when I was like 3 years old. so it constantly surprises me. But like when Pa Kent died, she just was beside herself. And then when things started to happen later, where there's like some suspense, she just was absolutely, she didn't want anything to do with it. When the movie was over, I told them to give me their rating between 1 and 10, and she gave it a 2. So, like a 2. Zach was glued to the screen, but he also, when it gets to be, when something's suspenseful, he can get a little bit nervous as well. After the initial viewing of the movie, he said he gave it a 5, which he gives everything a 5. unless it's one of his own movies that he's picking out, then it's a 10. So I've never heard him give anything other than a 5 or a 10. Yeah. But then the next day I asked him, if he thought any more about it, about the movie and stuff. And he said he decided he gave it an 8. So that was pretty, I felt like a decent score. But he liked it. We made a big point of like the whole, when he first, is saving, I don't know if you remember, but like saving Lois Lane, she's falling out of a helicopter. And, it's the famous quote where, you know, he says, "Don't worry, I've got you." And she says, "You've got me, who's got you?" Mm-hmm. So, made a point of like, that's a famous quote. And so Allie liked that quote. She says that was good, but she still gives it a 2. But for myself, I enjoyed rewatching it for the first time in a long, long time. And Gene Hackman, as a Luther and stuff like that. It's, not the typical Luther you would have read about, read in the comic books at that time or even since, but it was good. It was well done. The other movie that I watched on my own, this week was, Rodan. Of, Godzilla fame. For anyone not familiar, Rodan's the big, huge pterodactyl-like creature. The only one I could find on, and I don't, there must be other ones that a non-English version, but, the whole thing was dubbed, in English. It was free on Prime, but that was the only Rodan that I could even find, showing available. So, they were very obviously not speaking English, but that's what you were hearing was English. You could tell by the way that, by their mouths that they were not speaking the words that you were hearing.
one of the bad dubs.
Very bad, yeah. But, in retrospect, watching it, as an adult, it's to say it's a B monster movie is being generous, but I have, a lot of fond memories of that one particular one. My parents, when I was a little kid, they had one of the like film projectors, the reel to reel. And the one movie that I could remember that they actually owned was Rodan. So I had watched that when I was little, and I still own today the big Rodan figure. It's I don't know, a foot and a half long with the wingspan and maybe just over a foot tall. I guess it was part of the Shogun Warriors line that came out in 1979. I have the Godzilla from that as well. But so Rodan always had a special spot in my heart. So, honestly, just watching it for what the movie is and knowing what you're getting into, I really enjoyed it. They're testing, as many of these things go, they're testing atomic weapons and stuff, and it creates some cracks in the earth, and they discover the first there's huge insects that are coming out of there and killing people, and then as they're exploring the underground, they find a huge egg, and it hatches, and there's a big pterodactyl type creature that they call Rodan, and he eats it. That's what Rodan eats when it's born, is those bugs. And it turns out that there's more than one
one Rodan. There was two of them, and eventually with a volcano exploding and stuff, they got trapped. That's the Rodans end up dying at the end of the movie through that. But of course, you know, they have sequels and crossovers and, you know, Rodan against Godzilla and all that stuff. So it was a lot of fun to just watch again for the, for that I haven't seen since I was a little kid. So it was fun. We've been cleaning our basement, Chris, really, like it's just become just a place where we just were throwing things that we just didn't have room for. So over this whole quarantine, we've been doing a lot of cleaning and straightening the basement to the point where Stacy bought me a bunch of real sturdy shelves. So I moved all the comic book boxes that were like just kind of haphazardly on different things, whether on chests or like a makeshift wood shelf that happened to be down there when we moved. Moved all those boxes to these nice, all these comic boxes to the nice, sturdy shelves, got everything all nice and neat and organized. And, started to put up like, you know, some of the stuff like that Rodan action figure, put that out, kind of displayed down there with the different stuff. So, that made me think of Rodan. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to look to see if it's available on Prime, and it was. So, that's why I decided to watch it. But you know, the basement's looking good. I wish I would have taken a before and after, because it was a mess before, and now that whole side of the basement looks amazing. And I actually have room for another, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 comic book boxes. So that's huge, because I haven't had room to spare for comic book boxes in a very long time.
So that was their motivator.
That was part of it. That was, I think, Stacy's incentive to me to get down there and get a lot of that cleaned up, you know, that I'd have a special spot there. And in doing so, it freed up a lot of room where now she has more places that she can put different totes for crafts or for holidays and stuff. Mm-hmm. She has the room to take advantage of as well, and make the basement just look, is neater than it has since we moved into the house, you know?
Yeah. That's good. Yeah, I think a lot of people are like cleaning attics and basements and things like that right now.
Definitely. If you see, go around on trash, you'll see a lot of people that are doing the same as us, because there's a lot of things out on the curb for the car to pick up, that's for sure. But yeah, I'll have to send you a picture of the whole setup down there, because, you won't appreciate how it looked before and how it's come along, but it does look pretty nice and organized.
Yeah, that's cool.
Nice
to see.
Yeah.
All right.
You got anything?
No, I think that's it for me.
All right, that sounds good. But thanks for being able to meet up today. It was nice. It's been a little bit since you and I have been able to get together. So I was
good to catch
nice
up.
Time talking. Absolutely.
So you can find the episodes on geekbrunchpodcast.com. Mike is at Mike Myers Brunch. I am at Mythmaking ETC. And Rob is at Rob Krieger.
Yes. Twitter.
That's that on Twitter, of course, yeah. And I think that about does it.
Sounds good. Thanks again, Chris, and I hope you have a good weekend. I think it's supposed to get hot again towards the beginning to middle of the week.
Yeah, we had quite a bit milder of a weekend, but we had quite a heat wave this past week.
We sure did. So, kind of crazy.
Yeah. Well, stay cool. Enjoy the rest of your day. Hopefully I'll talk to you soon.
Yep, sounds good. Thanks, Chris. All right. Have a great day.
You too. All right. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.